Rambam. So this is not an isolated idea of the Rambam, it's part of the tradition, but the connection between what was said in... So now let's read Bickerman, because I think what he has to say is very relevant on everything that we're discussing. Faith and History. So this is chapter 25 from his book, Jews in the Greek Age. It's the book here. Okay. We are so accustomed to speaking of the people of the book that it's difficult for us to realize that the ordinary Jew of the early Hellenistic age hardly read the Torah. Even in the synagogue service, only isolated sentences of scripture were quoted. There was no Torah reading in the temple, and there were no religious schools. Only specialists, such as Ben Sira and his pupils seeking wisdom, studied the covenant book of the Most High God. The common Jew learned something about the Torah from the oral traditions of his family and from religious practice, just as a good Christian did in the Middle Ages, who had no access to the Latin Bible. But from the time of Alexander's conquest, the Jews from the Nile to the Indus lived in the Greek world and were exposed to the Greek spirit of rational research. The Jewish intellectuals who knew the Torah could not escape the influence of Greek curiosity and started to ask and answer questions in the Greek style. For instance, from Genesis, the Jew learned that in the beginning men consorted with soul maker and ruler of the universe, Noah, who was privileged to be God's companion, but that Abraham's fathers had turned to serve other gods. The return to the true deity did not come about until Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Consequently, in the spirit of Greek science, some Jewish writers of the Hellenistic days began to ask why and when the apostasy had occurred. In Jubilees, for some obscure reason, the corruption of mankind is ascribed to the generation of Tzurut, that is, to the fourth generation before Abraham. Other scholars, whose views were followed by in later sources, preferred to hold Enosh, Seth's son, or Nimrod, the grandson of Ham, responsible for this beginning of idolatry. So the Rambam is following that source and ascribing the beginning to Enosh. An Enochic writer thought that the fallen angels had led man to sacrifice to idols. Idols were, of course, things of naught, and according to Judith, no Jew any longer worshipped gods made by the hands of men. Still, the author of Jubilees, following Deuteronomy 32:17, asserted that behind the wooden stone lived potent and malicious evil spirits, and the two Enochic writers, the writers of the Epistle of Enoch and the writer of the Visions of Enoch, followed the biblical view. Generally speaking, however, it seems that Jews did not pay serious attention to the problem of idolatry. It is noteworthy that the two remarkable passages of Deuteronomy were neglected in the discussion of heathenism, 32:8, which states that the sons of God are the protectors of other people, whereas Israel is the Lord's portion, and 4:19, which states that the Lord allotted the worship of the hosts of heaven to all the nations except Israel. It is true that Ben Sira refers to the first passage, but only in order to stress the uniqueness of the chosen people. As for the worship of the stars, it was alien to the Greeks, and Plato hoped in vain that his astral deities would be worshipped Daphnis. Babylonian priests may later have developed an astral religion, but the Jews did not care for the barbarians, and the Babylonian bell was for them only a man-made and ridiculous idol. Having learned from the Greeks the historical approach to religion, the Jews began to ventilate a question in the air amongst their Greek neighbors. How did the deity first come to be known? The faithful knew that Abraham was the founder of the true religion. But although in the biblical account God chooses the patriarch, in Jubilees God's call to Abraham is turned into Abraham's quest for God. Thee and thy dominion have I chosen. Abraham is viewed as a safe, self-taught convert who comes to the truth when, observing the stars in order to foretell the coming of rain, he realizes that God alone gives and withholds rain. The esoteric Jewish writer here follows a theory of Plato's and Aristotle's, which continued to be popular in the Hellenistic age, that the sight of the starry heavens led man to recognize the existence of the gods. Astronomy, rather than leading to atheism, upheld faith, and Abraham, like Plato, deduced the designer from the design. It is interesting to note that it was the steady circular movement of the heavenly bodies that, for Plato, proved that it was God who caused this motion. The author of Jubilees, however, writing for a less sophisticated audience, made rain in his prognostication the source of Abraham's discovery. We may remember the prayer for rain in the Jewish liturgy, which calls upon him who gives rain upon the earth. The idea of Abraham as a stargazer fascinated the Jews of the Hellenistic age. The Jewish philosopher Aristobulus already quotes the Jewish poet whom we have met above, who, writing in Greek and pretending to be the legendary Orpheus, tells his readers that no mortal being had seen the Creator save Abraham, who was skilled in astronomy, and who had, according to the pseudo-Orpheus, anticipated the Greek theory of the uniform motion of the superimposed and concentric spheres in heaven. So here is this Jewish writer in the beginning of the 2nd century before the Common Era, attributing to Abraham the Platonic theory.
No, Plato was a couple of centuries before that.
A generation later, another Jewish or Samaritan writer proposed that Abraham had taught the science of the stars discovered by Hinnom, like to the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. For Philo, Abraham progressed from idolatry to stargazing, and then, by virtue of his own reasoning, to the discovery that the body of the universe was governed by an intelligence. Abraham's departure from Chaldea symbolizes his abandonment of astral worship. Let's skip this. I don't want to spend all the time reading this. Let's skip to the second paragraph on the right-hand page. Yet, although the heavens declared the glory of the Creator to Jews and Greeks alike, the Jews and the Greeks understood this message differently. The Greeks saw the universe as a polis, in other words, as a city governed by democratic elections from the, in the aristocratic class. The maker of the world was the demiurgus, that is, a craftsman in public service. And the relation between the elements, like the relation between the inhabitants of a polis, were governed by justice. In other words, there was a city, there was the city council made up of the representatives of the upper class, and there was a town planner who was in the service of the city. God is the town planner, but he has to conform to the laws of the people. Law. Consequently, Pythagoras of Samos, a contemporary of 2nd Isaiah, was both a prophetic figure and a scientist, and who, we are told, was the first to call the heaven cosmos, that is, the ordered universe, also announced to the Greeks that the study of numbers, that is, mathematics, could disclose the secret of the visible order in the universe. Scientists from his time onward, from the Greek astronomers to Newton and Einstein, applied his seminal idea to the study of the heavens. In the Jewish view, the world was governed by an absolute monarch who, in his goodness, sustained the work of creation just as he kept his promises to the patriarchs. The author of the Epistle of Jeremiah opposes the powerless idol to the God to whom the luminaries are obedient and who commands the lightning, the winds, and the clouds. The difference between this perspective of the universe and the mechanistic theory of Greek science may well be illustrated by a passage in the apologetic work of Aristotle mentioned earlier. Speaking of the creation, Aristotle cautions his Greek readers that although God has established the order of nature forever, it does not mean that he, as some believe, is now idle. Far from seeking to act, God, having arranged that universe, now holds it together. And we will see next week, I hope, that this was essential to Newton in his work in the 7th century, and constitutes a conflict between Leibniz and Newton. Newton needed God for his theory of gravitation and Newton's laws. You could not express Newton's laws according to Newton without God.
I'm not sure what it means that God holds the universe together.
Well, I gave you Newton as an example. According to Newton, first of all, you needed to have, I'll try to explain this in more detail next week, but for example, you may be familiar that there's a law that says, Newton, that says that force is equal to mass times acceleration. Now, in order to have acceleration, you have to have a notion of absolute space. Because, you know, if something is accelerating relative to one system of coordinates, it's not going to be accelerating relative to another system of coordinates. So you need to have absolute space. And when he was challenged by Leibniz and others as to what is this absolute space, he said it's God's sensorum. That is, it's the mode by which God apprehends being. I suspect that he may have, in fact, gotten that idea because we know that Newton was reading the Hebrew scriptures in Hebrew at the time. He may have read Rashi and he may have accorded the Hamakom as the name of God. But certainly the fact that Newton needed God even to begin to formulate his laws was one ingredient. And the second is that Newton, in his theory of the planetary motion, the planets were unstable. They run down. So you needed God to keep the thing going. So it was like winding up the clock every now and then to keep the planets going. I'm just saying that God. That's a good view. We'll come to that. It took 100 years from Newton to Laplace, until the stability of the solar system could be established in a reasonable way. See, the planets are pulling one another apart, and there's no reason to believe that they shouldn't either crash into one another or fly off into outer space. So from Newton until Laplace, when Laplace wrote his work, Napoleon, having browsed through it, asked him, I don't see God mentioned in here anywhere. And he said, Sir, je n'ai eu pas besoin de cette hypothèse. Sir, I did not need that particular hypothesis. So it was only with Laplace that God was eliminated from celestial mechanics. But, I mean, and so the influence of religion on science is something that's not very popularly understood, but was an essential ingredient. But here, let me summarize. Well, I'll read some of those citations perhaps next week, in particular the correspondence between Leibniz and Clark. Leibniz was writing to Clark, who was a cleric, but Clark was sort of a straw man for Newton. I'm sure he wrote every single letter that he got from Leibniz to Newton, and then Newton told him what to write back. So Newton doesn't appear in this correspondence, but he's behind the scenes. It's a very interesting correspondence. Okay. All right. So that's what it means. God not only, according to the Newtonian theory, that is, before Laplace came on the scene, God not only was there for the Newton's laws to be present, because they don't make space a sense of absolute space, and absolute space is the way in which God recognizes everything. But secondly, God had to keep the machinery going by turning up the crank every now and then. Okay. Far from ceasing to act, God, having arranged the universe, now holds it together. So within the Newtonian theory, as opposed to the Laplacian theory of the universe, this was certainly reasonable. Some 350 years after Aristotle, the famous Greek physician Galen, roughly a contemporary of Rabbi Judah, the compiler of the Mishnah, clearly recognizes the difference between the two worldviews. The Jew believes that God, for God, everything is possible, while the Greek philosopher argues that God neither attempts nor can interfere with the working of the mechanism he created. I want to make two statements about this. We'll see for the Rambam, as we'll see soon enough, this conflict between the Greek view and the Jewish view, as summarized by Galen, whom certainly the Rambam read thoroughly, does not exist, because for the Rambam, God is not a person. Both of these pictures are anthropomorphisms, which don't apply to God. God not being a person, you can't formulate the question in one way or the other. The second point that I want to make is the paragraph that we read just before, starting with Yehel, about the relationship between the polis and the laws of nature, as being... I never met Dickerman. I regret not having yet met him. I could have. But a person that I did meet who expressed almost the identical view is the great archaeologist William Boxwell Albright. He was a great man, and professor at Johns Hopkins. I met him because in those days you had to pass language exams. I think I had to pass exams in four languages. So I had my French and my German. Too hard. And then I knew some Italian from the street, because we were always getting into fights with Italian kids on the east side. And I figured, what the hell, I know Hebrew, why shouldn't I put that down? Of course, the only one at the university who was equipped to test me in Hebrew was Albright. And so I come into his office, feeling pretty cocksure. The Italian went very easily. But then comes the Hebrew and he asks me some questions about biblical Hebrew, no problem, Shemaic Hebrew, Rabbinic Hebrew, no problem. And then he starts to ask me questions about Bialik. Now, I've never read Bialik. In the yeshivas, they didn't teach Bialik. This was not part of my education. It turned out that he was a good friend of Bialik's, and Bialik moved to Israel, and he was able to cite all of his poetry, a lot of his poetry, by heart. But he was generous and didn't flunk me, even though I didn't know my Bialik. But
what I really appreciated was many years later, I think it was in the late 50s, early 60s, he got an honorary degree from Harvard University. He was a great archaeologist of the 20th century. And he called me up and invited me to lunch. I mean, I thought, you know, it's a young, progressive Stanford kid at the time. And then he started telling me this theory of his, which is that the foundations of science, the idea of the existence of natural law, which was the Greek invention, stemmed from the fact that the Greeks had a polis, that is, a city which was ruled by a system of laws, and all of the functionaries in the city had to be subservient to the laws rather than vice versa. So exactly the same idea that Pickering is propounding here, I heard from an entirely different source.
I've lived a long time and had the privilege of being up great man. He was certainly one of the
very traditional.
Very traditional, right? Yeah. Here at the next page, you can actually see the citation from the Quran. Lo, Abraham said to his father Azar, takest thou idols for gods, for Asibi and thy people in manifest error. So also did we show Abraham the power and the laws of the heavens and the earth, that he might with understanding have servitude, etc., etc. You can read the rest of the passages. So here is the Islamic version of the Medrash Agadol, and then, as I said, the Islamic philosophers took this to mean that this was Plato's argument. So the Rambam is putting Plato's argument in the mouth of Abraham Avinu, who has a venerable tradition, starting from the beginning of the 2nd century BC, passing through some underground channel that I don't know, for the next 700 or 800 years to the Medrash Rabbah, from the Medrash Agadol, to the Quran, from the Quran to the Islamic philosophers, and from the Islamic philosophers back to the Rambam. So this is full circle. Okay, now I want to, do I have time? Yes. I want to, the next selection that I xeroxed to you is, I'm not going to read it all because it's just be much too difficult to explain each step. But this is from my friend Professor Davidson's book there. You can hold it up if you want to see it. This is Al-Farabi, Ibn Sina, Avicenna, and Averroes on intellect. Remember that there was a whole theory of the notion of intelligence and intellect which existed in the Islamic tradition, and of which the Rambam was one. So on the bottom of the right-hand side of my page 12, in Moses Maimonides we encounter one more time a translunar universe consisting of celestial spheres, the souls that move them, and the incorporeal intelligences, or angels in religious parlance, that inspire the souls to do so. So remember, according to Maimonides and this whole theory, each of the celestial spheres has its own intelligence, which is emanated from the sphere above it. The analogy that I gave last time, I think, is reasonably good. Namely, you can just think of a central computer, and then there's a terminal connected to that, which draws its information from the central computer, and then there's a terminal connected from that all the way down, and we are sort of little terminals with wireless modems connected to the active intellect, which is the intelligence of the sublunar sphere. Okay. On the upper right-hand side of my page 13, much of the picture sketched thus far is unknown prior to the Arabic Aristotelians. In other words, although the Rambam seems to attribute these ideas all the way back to Aristotle, most of the details, in fact, are inventions of the Arabic Aristotelians. And in crediting the active intellect with the emanation of the sublunar matter, matter in all sublunar forms, Maimonides has endorsed these theses peculiar to Ibn Sina. Nevertheless, he names, quote, Aristotle as the author of the scheme, and he further maintains that the scheme is, with a qualification, shared by scripture, etc. So, in fact, what the Rambam is doing is basically using Ibn Sina, incredibly even more than that, Al-Farabi. To understand the details of all of this, you have to read carefully, and it's not worth the effort because all of this stuff is just a lot baloney. It's just
plain wrong. So even though the Rambam believed in all of these things passionately, that we should spend much of our time going into the details of these theories is terribly relevant. Let me just go
say again. Wait. Here you have
They had overflow.
What do they mean by active?
They mean that there is an intelligence pervading the world, and when we think and are able to understand something, it's because we share an overflow from that intelligence. It's an emanation.
And that intelligence is God?
No, that intelligence comes from other intelligence, which comes from another intelligence, and the whole system is God. Yes.
Absolutely true.
Except, of course,
by not being any more observant, but less observant.
Yeah, for Maimonides, observance is only a method whereby you can free yourself of undesirable appetites and desires and concentrate on the true knowledge.
But understanding physics, it could make you a better or worse person.
No, according to the Rambam, being a better or worse person is understanding physics. Being a good moral man, giving contributions to charity, praying every day in shul, is not the ultimate purpose of mankind. Well, it's not good to kill physics, but to kill people, because if you kill people, you only do that on the basis of emotions. And those emotions will rule you. You ask me what the Rambam's position is. The Rambam's, are you arguing with me or are you arguing with the Rambam? The Rambam says that the whole purpose of these necessary beliefs and necessary laws is that you should reach a stage in which you're free to think about the ultimate thing.
Well, I guess we have to understand where these people live. Understand where they live, then there was a significantly less amount of number of scientists per capita.
Oh, yes, we'll come to that.
Okay. So for them, scientists were something extraordinary.
We will come to that, we'll come exactly to that point in a moment.
Okay.
All right, I just want to end from this and then I'll take your question. On page 17, just at the first paragraph on the right-hand side, regarding human immortality, an issue with obvious ramifications for religion, Maimonides' rationalism outweighed any religious scruples. On page 17 over here, at the time, he writes that human immortality is the exclusive outcome of man's intellectual development.
And what
he writes that human immortality is the exclusive outcome of man's intellectual development, and he refrains from defending the individual immortality of the human soul or intellect. In other words, when you die, nothing of you individually remains. All that remains is the intellectual achievements that you made during your lifetime. If you prove a number of good theorems, they will be reabsorbed into the act of intellect, and that's the only immortality that you have. Okay?
Isn't the Rambam 13 principles of faith, am I getting something confused?
You're not getting something confused, but you have to distinguish between necessary beliefs and correct beliefs.
So you're saying that these...
We're from the necessary.
So this is all the necessary.
Everybody around this table except me conforms to the necessary beliefs. I'm the only one here who understands the theory of relativity, and therefore I can deal with, maybe you do also, with correct beliefs. Okay. Now, I'm going to skip the next page, which is important, but you should read it, which is Maimonides' take on the prophecy of Moses. There's a whole book there by Kreisel on prophecy in... No, he's absolutely consistent.
I think it's just a little too convenient to have this division between that which is necessary and that which is...
That's the Stoic position. Okay. At any event, you'll read what Kreisel has to say, which I also agree with, that as far as the Nevoat Moshe, Ma'amad Har Sinai, and stuff like that, there's no supernatural event involved. It's just that Moses was the supremely intelligent person who was able to understand both the true aspects of God and also how to enact various laws which would serve to lead to human perfection. Okay? So the Rambam also negates any kind of supernatural intervention in the giving of the Torah to Israel.
There's no Torah Messina.
There is Torah Messina. Yeah. What that means is that Moshe Rabbeinu was very smart.
What have God?
Come to that. That's the most shocking.
Well, but it's more than he's very smart, right? It's that it unites with the Godhead. In the intellectual discovery, there's a fusion.
That's what intellect is about.
Right.
The motive, he didn't think that we have synapses in nerve cells of our brain. The way in which you're being smart is to conjoin with the active intellect. Being smart and conjoining with the active intellect are the same thing, because all you are is a modem, and if you have a good connection with the central computer, you're smart.
But
my point is, it's a different concept of revelation, but it's not a negation of revelation.
It's a negation of anything supernatural. There's no supernatural event. Everything was within the framework of nature. Nature happens to consist of a situation in which intelligence is not individual. Intelligence is part of the structure of the universe.
Okay. So by supernatural, you mean there wasn't anything that was different than had happened the day before or the day after.
Exactly.
I mean, obviously, the conception of nature is one that we find difficult or strange,
mm-hmm.
but it was just that it wasn't that something strange happened on that particular day, different than happened the day before the day after.
No, that's correct.
True,
but Moses' prophecy has nothing to do. Moses' prophecy represents an extreme of nature in the sense that he was the smartest person around. It's like saying that Einstein was an extreme of nature.
I thought we knew that too long, but the extremes of nature came together at a particular time, which caused no...
There was no such things coming together.
That's the assumption.
We'll come to that. Okay. Now, I want to go on to the question that all of you must be asking, which is on my page 21. B'nisharah, this is now from the Rambam and the Perush HaMishnah. So this is his earliest works. That's what I mean by saying that he was consistent from his early age into his old age. B'nisharah kan she'elacha, there's one remaining question. V'hi, yesh l'mak shalomar, someone could ask, atem kvar amartem, shelo himtzia hachmah elohit shum davar v'batalah, the divine wisdom did not create anything for nothing. The shekol ha-nevarim tachat galgal ha-yareach hu ha-nechbad shabahem, ha-adam hu ha-nechbad shabahem, amongst all the creatures below the lunar sphere, the man is the most honored. The shetachlit ha-min ha-enoshi hu ha-sagat ha-muskalot, and the whole purpose of the human existence is to understand the intelligences, in other words, to really know theoretical physics. In Cain, Madua Himtzi Hashem Kol Bnei Adam. Why did God create all these other people around? She'enam Masigim Muskal. They're unable to understand the Einstein field equations. Ve'anachnu Ro'im She'rov Bnei Adam Reikim Mimada. Most people are empty of science. Rodfei Hata'avot, and are running after their impulses. Va'adam Hamulumad, and the educated person, Ha'parush Nadir Uplai. he is exceptional. You can only find one such man in several generations. So what are all these other people around for? Why were they created? Hatshuva. Shekol metziyut otam hanivraim l'shtei sibo. All of the rest of mankind has been created for two purposes. Ha'achat, one, l'sharet et oto hayachid, to serve the... I told you, you would not want to let this man into your shul. Or into your house either. But look, I'm not making anything up here. It's crystal clear. Ki elu, ki ilu hayu kol b'nei adam lamdanim mipalsachim. If everybody were philosophers, haya olam habei, the world would go to hell. V'haya adam kolam imenu b'zman katzar. A man would disappear in a short order. L'fisha adam chaser ma'od. A man is very needy. Zakuk l'dvarim rabim. He needs many things. The person would have to learn how to hoe, and how to reap, and how to thresh, and how to grind, he would have to learn all of these trades before he could even get any food. And he would have to learn how to spin and how to weave in order to have something to wear. Uvinyan kidei levnot lo makom lachasot, and you have to learn how to build a house in order to have a house to build it. Yaseh keilim lechaleva, v'lo yaspik chayin tushelach, and even if you lived as long as Methuselah, it would not be long enough kidei lelmod kol hamalachot sha'adam zakuch lehem v'echlech l'man kiyumeh. The im came matay yilmar oto adam chachma v'yavin mabam ada l'fach nimtzu kol elu kedei la'asot avodot halalu shalom tzorich lahem v'nimtza amula b'shvil atzmo. All of these people are necessary so that the theoretical physicist can sit in his study and do his work. Is this Yeah, he's anti-aesthetic just like Plato was anti-aesthetic. But Plato, the poets, were the worst possible people. Remember, the sin, the original sin,
there's
the sin.
There's science and philosophy, and we all know it, but we don't. It's not really part of the culture except by knowing about where
the Greek
category
is. Still with us. Yes, but that was the sin of Adam Harishon, after all. That he replaced the categories of truth and falsehood by the category with good and bad. The replacement of intellectual achievement with aesthetic judgment was the primary sin for which man. Absolutely. Let's skip down to the second. So we understand that one reason why all of you people are around is that the true scholar will be able to concentrate on his work. And the second reason why people who are not great scholars are hanging around, there are very few true scholars. Shekachi v'achachmar elokit, because that was God's wisdom demanded that. But ain lo ma b'kol ma shechivoto achachmar yishenel madu achivoto, k'mo she'en lo ma madu agalgalim tishav kofvei halechet shevav yesod anol, shekol eilu v'chol odem alehem kach yu mekirat yitzua, b'nchar ro'esh shekvar v'yalmu alehem ha'lashon devazel ma, etc. etc. ולפיכך, המצאו ההמון להיות לצוות לבני העלייה, to keep the philosopher company. In other words, I need all of you people because I can't give a shiur if there's nobody sitting around the table to listen to me. So therefore, in order to have company, that's another reason why the people who are not the philosophers have been created by God. So So there are two sources. One is the I need a butcher, and I need a doctor, and I need a tailor, and I need all of these people to keep me going, and occasionally I need company. That's what the Rambam is saying. So that's the two answers to this question about why so many people who are not
sad.
Born.
Sad.
It's very sad, but there it is.
Did the Rambam believe that he was picked out by God and made more intelligent than others?
Sure. Picked out by God means what?
He was chosen.
What does that mean?
Well, was it just haphazard that he became so bright?
It's not a question of what haphazard means. But everything is by design, because everything is part of a system.
Why did he waste his time being a fourth physician and all that stuff?
Who's going to support him?
His brother died.
His brother was killed. His brother, who was supporting him, was killed. So he needed to earn a living, unfortunately. He was depressed for half a year when his brother died, and he realized that he had to go out and earn a living. Right. And of course, he also believed with Plato that he was the leader of the community. In other words, So as I said at the beginning of this shiur, the Rambam is maybe not someone who you would like to join your minion. I should add, by the way, this is really sad. If you think the Rambam is sad, this is really sad. When I was in the Bialystok Shul last Sunday, the first day of Rosh Chodesh, I noticed a book put out by Art Scroll on the shelf called Risk on Chumash. The new book, Risk on Chumash. And of course, they cite this Rambam with approval, but of course, it's not the theoretical physicists for whom the whole world has been created, but the students in the Bristol Yeshiva. Right, so... okay.
What does he say about any of this? Is it restricted to physical sciences and the like, or do any social sciences qualify? If some Greek person is working on the development of democratic thinking,
all of those are just, if you say there's no,
those equally.
No, they're not important only in the sense that they help to organize society so that the philosopher can devote himself to the full philosophy. Okay? Now, I want to do two or three things which will take me 3 minutes or 4 minutes past 9:30. I xeroxed to you what I regard as the most radical and most controversial chapter in the Rambam altogether, and that's Chapter 68 of Book 1. You can read it. I will not read it. And you come to your own conclusion as to what the Rambam says. Because you asked me how did the Rambam view God, and I believe that the correct reading of this chapter, and on this I'm following Professor Keenis, rather than his student, my good friend Professor Davidson, who's a little bit too firm for me on this particular issue. I believe what the Rambam is saying is that God is to be identified with the system of natural laws. In other words, the system of all the intelligences of the universe, the Schrodinger's equation, the Einstein field equation, Newton's laws, Maxwell's equations, all of those intelligible laws of the universe, the body of those laws is what is God.
But before there was Maxwell, before there was...
The laws were still there.
How did you know?
Well, remember, and this comes to your question, the Rambam, after all, did not believe in bodies. The Rambam thought that Aristotle knew everything. There was a big crisis in Spanish Andalusian philosophy because they realized that Aristotle was wrong as far as the celestial motions were concerned. Already Ptolemy had realized that the Platonic theory of the celestial spheres could not adequately describe the motion of planets, and by the time of the Rambam you had the very great Arabic astronomer Al-Biruni, who improved on Ptolemy to a very great extent. So there was a scandal, to use that word, in Islamic philosophy as to what was going on in the motions of the celestial of the stars, and that's why the Rambam on occasion says that we can never know what's going to happen. So according to the Rambam, all of the laws had already been was discovered by Aristotle, and of course they're all wrong. But I would say that the Rambam would have no problem with saying that the laws are there. Maxwell didn't invent something, he simply discovered these equations. And as you say, the more we know about theoretical physics, the more religious we become, because we're able to get closer to God. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, now, of course, in doing this, the Rambam has to take the position that just about everything, like the entire story of Bereshit that we read last week, is all a parable, right? The Maaseh Bereshit really represents the theory of the four elements and the emanation from the upper spheres to the lower spheres. So all of the details of that story are not to be taken literally, but rather to be reinterpreted in terms of Aristotelian philosophy. And that's, of course, a really dreadful, even more dreadful than the other things that he does, because there's really nothing that you can trust. What we have, of course, is a situation which is far more complicated. Instead of talking about last week, let's talk about this coming week. Until, say, the beginning of the middle of the 18th century, it's safe to say that everybody in England and Western Europe believed the story of the flood and the various other things that are told in the Bible literally. And then gradually, as geology began to improve, people realized that maybe there was no such universal flood. Evidence doesn't exist to say that there was a flood of waters that covered the whole earth. And there really is a very readable book, of course, written from an extremely anti-religious point of view, called Genesis and Geology, which describes the retreat of the literal interpretation of the Genesis story behind the advance of geology. And so the problem with believing, the Rambam would have no problem with this at all, because none of these stories that are in the Bible can be understood literally anyway. And of course, that's a pretty bad situation. And then, of course, we have more information, and that is at the end of the 19th century, with the discovery of the Gilgamesh epic, we realized that there were other flood stories which seem to parallel in many ways and with some essential differences the story of the flood. And of course one didn't know whether this represented some local flood in the Euphrates, some river flood and so on, but apparently there was a tradition of a flood in the region going far back before the time of Moshe Rabbeinu of the Hamari. And I guess the most recent explanation of it is the stuff that's only been discovered in the past 5 or 10 years is what was happening at the Black Sea. You all know that?
I know.
Yes. Yeah. There's an interesting fact, which is known for centuries, about the Bosphorus, which is that on the surface, the water is flowing from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, but at the very bottom, the water is flowing from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea. So in other words, if you were in a rowboat and you dropped a basket with some lead so that you could be pulled along to the bottom current, you could go against the upper current. And what was discovered in the mid-90s was that, in fact, as you say, the Black Sea dried up and was some 400 feet below the level of the Mediterranean. And one catastrophic event, and there were many people living around the shore of the previous Black Sea, and then with one catastrophic event, the Mediterranean flooded into the Black Sea. So there was a major flood at about 7,000 years ago, which dispersed the people and a lot of other things, and the evidence for it is overwhelming. He spoke to one of the authors, Right, okay.
Walter Pittman, I guess. So, you know, there's new information coming in every day, and as you say, to simply say that here's the guy that we know. That's how old it is. You know, one should always try to take into account the latest scientific and other kinds of information that we have, and simply reject something as allegory without having any origin behind the myth or behind the story is as much an error as committing a scientific error. All right. It took place up in close enough, and with people who had to run into, so the origin of the Mesopotamian society, according to him, were people who were running away from the flood in the Black Sea. All right, I've run over my time. We will continue with some of this next time, and there will be some things even more troubling, because we would like to see what the biblical conception of God is as opposed to the philosophical conception of God. And for that, I highly recommend this book by Kubel, which we will quote from. The God of Old, new book. Yes, I had some questions.
You said the Rambam was...
Yes.